Hey guys, and welcome back. Or if you're new here, hi, my name's Georgia, and on my platforms here on the internet, I talk about true crime and history and general nerdy things. For the people who have been around here for a while, you will already know the deal with these case updates episodes, but for those of you who are new here, these episodes are kind of my attempt to stay accountable for the cases that I cover on my platforms. And also for helping you guys stay accountable as well. You really shouldn't just forget about the case the moment a video or a podcast finishes, because for the people involved in these true life stories, they don't end. And we're in the business of truly helping here, spreading the word as much as possible. So I try and keep up to date with these cases, and then in turn, I keep you guys up to date. I report back here every few months with big or small updates and cases. Sometimes it's just tiny extra details released by the authorities. Sometimes it's identifications, cases being solved, cases being closed. I share everything. Today we're going to be sharing updates in the cases of Ben Needham, JonBenet Ramsey, Fred the Head, the Long Island serial killer, some Jane Does that are sort of like eking closer to identification, and much, much more. And we're going to begin with some pretty huge updates in the case of Jennifer Kessie. 24-year-old Jennifer Kessie has been missing from Orlando, Florida since January 23rd, 2006, so almost 18 years ago. She was reported missing after not turning up to work, and her car was soon found parked about a mile from her home, with security footage showing somebody parking her car and then walking away. Whoever this person was, it was not Jennifer. But the poor camera quality means to this very day, this person remains unidentified, although it is believed to have been a male in workman's clothes. Evidence found in her home, so a wet towel, her clothes laid out, did suggest that she woke up that morning and started to prepare for work, and then she disappeared, likely when she was walking to her car, seeing as there was no sign of forced entry or a struggle in her home. In January this year, on the 17th anniversary of her disappearance, the Kessie family told Fox 35 that they had new leads in this case, and the family's investigators are working very closely with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement to try and get some answers. The case was originally investigated by the Orlando Police Department, but the Kessies have never really been happy with how it was handled by them, saying that the entire investigation had been botched from the very beginning. I mean, Jennifer's disappearance was immediately dismissed as her having had a fight with her boyfriend, that she'd be back, and obviously that wasn't the case. The family spent $80,000 suing the Orlando PD to try and get the original case files, and they were successful in the end, allowing a full review of this case from the very beginning. Fox 35 wrote in January 2023, evidence photos obtained by Fox News suggest a violent struggle took place in the front hood of the 24-year-old woman's car. Jennifer's father said, "It looked like somebody was thrown down on the top of the hood, arms spread out and then dragged back, almost like off the hood, to the point where you could almost see fingers scribbling down the hood." This is something the family were never made aware of at the time, and then as this year has gone on, more information has been released. In September, it was revealed that the original record stated that the Orlando PD collected DNA in Jennifer's car, something which at the time they said they did not do. Now, with the case under the care of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, they're hoping this DNA can actually be tested. Now, I couldn't find confirmation this is something that's definitely going to happen, but hopefully it does. It seems like the logical next step. Of course, even once the DNA has been tested, there's no guarantee there will be that of her killers, but it's much more than they had previously in this investigation when all they had was this obscure security camera footage. Jennifer's uncle, Bill Gilmore, has written a book about his niece's disappearance in which he said that Jennifer was a very predictable person in kind of the best way possible. She was very intelligent, she was always conscious of her surroundings and always planned for her safety. She was in a very happy and healthy relationship with her boyfriend, she was just generally very content in life. Except for the fact that she had been very concerned about construction workers in her building, Mosaic at Millennia, staying in vacant lots, and she even went as far as filing a formal complaint to her property's management company at one point. She said the men made her feel very uncomfortable, she lived alone, she was a 24-year-old beautiful young woman living alone, and she always felt like she was being watched. They stared at her constantly, they made remarks, she was just very uncomfortable. It's long been theorised that it was one of these construction workers who was responsible for her disappearance, but that is just a theory. But maybe now, with potential DNA, they might be able to confirm it. Quite a rogue update I have for you comes in the case of Tupac Shakur, a case I'm sure you've all heard of. Now, when I originally made my video on Tupac, I got so many comments ripping me for my pronunciation of Tupac, and I was so confused, because obviously he was a massive, massive artist. I'd heard his name a million times before, and I never thought I was saying it wrong. I was so confused. So in my research for this update, I found out how his name is actually pronounced, and this is going to blow some of your minds. So this is the Google pronunciation thing. If you click on the British pronunciation, it is
Tupac.
Tupac. If you go onto the American pronunciation,
Tupac.
Tupac. Anyway, a wonderful viewer left me a comment on my last case updates video with a whole list of case updates I just somehow missed over the previous few months. So I want to say a huge thank you to that commenter, to that viewer. I'm not going to share your name with the world because I don't know how you feel about that, but you know who you are incredible. I find out so many of these updates from you guys leaving like real-time comments on the relevant video, so please, please keep that up. For those of you that don't know, Tupac was an American rapper who was murdered in a drive-by shooting in Las Vegas on September 13th, 1996, aged just 25. He was considered to be one of the most influential and successful rappers of all time, one of the best-selling music artists of all time. As you can imagine, his murder has led to any number of theories over the years. These wild conspiracies as to him still being alive on an island somewhere, theories over his rival Notorious B.I.G. being the one responsible for his death, but Notorious B.I.G. would then be killed in a similar incident just 6 months later. For almost 30 years, Tupac's murder would be one of the music industry's most enduring unsolved crimes, but at the end of September 2023, it was announced by the Nevada authorities that they had finally made an arrest. Dwayne Davis, known as Keith D, was a former gang leader and self-admittedly one of the last surviving witnesses of the murder, and he's now being indicted for the murder for allegedly being the orchestrator of the shooting. According to The Guardian, prosecutors allege that he admitted to serving as the on-the-ground, on-site commander of the shooting. The motive? Well, Tupac was apparently involved in a fight with Davis's nephew, Orlando Baby Lane Anderson, in a Vegas casino shortly before the murder, of which there is security footage evidence. Now, I kind of wish I could tell you it was pure investigation that finally led to this arrest, but Davis actually implicated himself in his 2019 tell-all memoir, despite being known to investigators since the very beginning and being identified as a lead suspect as far back as sort of like 2008-2009. It's always been known or suspected that he was in the car from which the shooting happened, but they can never quite have enough evidence to arrest him for it. Describing the moments before the murder, Davis wrote in his memoir, "I pulled out the Glock that Zip had given me and tossed it in the back seat. Bubble Up did the driving, Baby Lane, so the nephew, and Freaky were riding in the back." He said Tupac noticed them and made an erratic move and began to reach down beneath the seat, and that then the fireworks started at that moment, and it happened so quickly, the fireworks obviously being the shooting. On November 2nd of this year, Davis, who is now 60 years old, appeared in a Las Vegas court and pled not guilty to the charge, which is open murder with use of a deadly weapon with a gang enhancement. The judge said prosecutors are not seeking the death penalty in this case, but Davis could be jailed for life if he's convicted. The following week, the trial date was set for June 3rd, 2024, and Davis remains in jail whilst his legal team sort of filed documents for his release until trial. His defence lawyers declined to comment on this case outside of court, saying they haven't yet had time to examine all the evidence, which is said to be voluminous. I guess we're just going to have to wait for the trial to see the outcome here, so come back around June and I'll update you again, if it doesn't get delayed, obviously. Or you can subscribe to my channel now and stick around until then if you fancy. Moving on to the next four cases, we are going to be talking about children, so Ben Needham, Garrett Phillips, JonBenet Ramsey and Andrew Gosden. If you struggle with hearing about true crime involving children, the timestamps will be in the description box, you can just breeze on past. Ben Needham was just 21 months old when he disappeared on the Greek island of Kos on the 24th of July 1991. He was an English child who was staying with his family at his maternal grandparents' home in Heraklis. On the day he disappeared, he was in the care of his grandparents. He was just sort of like playing in and around the farmhouse when they eventually realised that he was gone around 2:30 p.m. They originally assumed that he just sort of wandered off or that his uncle Stephen had taken him out, but when there was no trace of him, they notified the police, beginning a 32-year search. This became one of the most well-known UK missing persons cases, and you'll often still find Ben's name and face in the papers. Police have said in recent years they believe that Ben died in a tragic accident involving a digger on the scene of the farmhouse, which was undergoing these big renovations at the time of his disappearance. But his family are still begging people to come forward with any information, and they have a Help Find Ben Needham Facebook page on which they're doing this, offering a £7,500 reward for any information leading to his discovery. And then in May 2022, the body of a child was found in the River Danube in Germany, wrapped in foil and weighed down with a flagstone slab. It was very clear that whoever put this body in the river did not intend for it to be found. The boy was believed to be aged 5 or 6, and obviously the circumstances around his death were deemed to be suspicious, whether he was a victim of trafficking, abduction, or violence. The German authorities contacted Interpol, which is the international police agency, for assistance in the investigation, and they went public for the first time ever with a black notice. Now, black notices are usually only circulated internally with Interpol's network of police forces, but this time they went public. They need to identify this child. Obviously, after this went public, Kerry Needham, Ben's mum, heard about the body and had high hopes that it could have been Ben. She said the facial reconstructions did have similarities with the same kind of eye shape. And then she realised there had been a connection to Germany in the original investigation many, many years ago that just didn't really end up going anywhere. A prisoner once told them that Ben was in Germany 5 years after his disappearance. This prisoner was Adonis Bedzios, who phoned from inside prison and said that once he'd escaped jail and he saw Ben with a family of travellers in Viria in Greece. He then claimed that Ben was now living in Germany with one of his relatives, causing the British consul to Athens to then become involved. At one point, a handover of Ben was even promised, but of course, no one turned up, there was no sign of Ben. So then years later, when the body of a boy is found in a German river, the connection immediately comes to mind. Kerry contacted local authorities, who in turn contacted Interpol, and DNA testing was conducted to confirm or deny the connection. In September this year, it was confirmed that a DNA sample did not match Ben, which was just another setback for the family, who at this point just want to find him. They just want to know that he's at peace and what happened. I also hope the unidentified boy is reunited with his name soon. If anyone has any details in regards to that, then you're asked to contact Interpol. I may do a whole video soon on the Danube River boy, but I'm really not sure how much information is out there about this case as it stands. Moving on to the case of Garrett Phillips, a story I originally covered many, many years ago. 12-year-old Garrett was murdered in his home in Potsdam in upstate New York on October 24, 2011, with police very quickly turning their attention to Nick Hillary, the ex-boyfriend of Garrett's mother, Tandy. Hillary went to trial for the murder and was actually eventually acquitted by the judge. It was a very controversial case, with many people believing that police only focused on Hillary because he was a black man in this very white community. And it was revealed in the course of the trial that the public state prosecutor withheld exculpatory evidence from the defence. It was just basically a shit show from the very beginning. Nick Hillary would later file a lawsuit citing multiple county personnel violated his rights in the investigation, arrest, and prosecution. He claims they violated his civil rights when they singled him out as the only suspect. However, in June 2022, a federal court judge in Albany ruled that his argument didn't have any merit as he wasn't able to prove this alleged discrimination. Hillary then challenged this claim, taking it all the way to the US Court of Appeals, where the judge once again stood by the original findings. I don't know what Hillary's next steps are going to be, if it's going to be pursued any further, but he is convinced that his civil rights were violated. Hillary has always maintained his innocence, saying he definitely didn't kill Garrett, and this whole case did expose some pretty big systemic issues within the Potsdam police. But in all the talk, it seems that Garrett can often get lost. He was a 12-year-old boy who was brutally murdered inside his own home, and it seems there's been little further investigation into his death. Who did kill him? Hopefully one day we'll find out, but we don't know because police only focused on Nick Hillary. For right or for wrong, they didn't really look at anyone else. The next case I want to talk about, with almost constant updates at the moment, is that of JonBenet Ramsey. There seems to be a real push from JonBenet's father, John, to get this case solved just over the last few months. Now, I know this is a really controversial case, it's one that everyone seems to have their opinions on, but I'm just here to share the latest news. I know that many people think that John himself is responsible, but I must say that I've never personally subscribed to that train of thought, but hey, we've all got our opinions. I do find myself questioning why he'd be pushing so much for answers in a case if he is the one to be guilty. That just doesn't really make any sense. JonBenet Ramsey was just 6 years old when she was killed in her family's home in Boulder, Colorado on Christmas Day in 1996. She was a child beauty queen, so one of the theories has always been that she had an obsessed adult admirer. She was found in the basement of her home about 7 hours after she was reported as missing and had suffered with a blow to the head and strangulation. Inside the home, they found a ransom note that's been the centre of speculation ever since, with investigators immediately suspecting that Patsy, JonBenet's mum, was the one to write this note. Well, in articles from just 1 week ago now, John Ramsey has said that new handwriting analysis proves once and for all that his wife is innocent. The analysis was conducted by two independent handwriting experts, Mazelle Martin and Dawn McCarty, both of whom found significant similarities between the ransom note and the handwriting of convicted paedophile Gary Oliver, who's currently serving time in prison. Now, Oliver has confessed to the crime of killing JonBenet in the past, and according to the Daily Mail, the handwriting analysis revealed a score of 1.75 on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being a definitive identical match and 5 being no match. I don't love using the Daily Mail as a source, you all know where I stand with that paper, but sometimes they're the only place with this information and direct interviews, and so that's why I'm using it here. McCarty said, "There's too many things that are just hard to ignore. That doesn't mean to say that he 100% wrote the ransom note, but it does call for a serious and more thorough investigation into Gary Oliver." Handwriting analysis is definitely not an exact science, but as McCarty said, it is interesting that the writing seems to be so similar. But that's not the only information I have to share in JonBenet's case, because we also have a DNA update. I mentioned in an updates video quite a few months ago now that a crime lab was conducting new DNA testing, with the Ramseys hoping that it would clear their names once and for all. John Ramsey spoke to News Station about this DNA, stating, "We know there's evidence that was taken from the crime scene that was never tested for DNA. There are a few cutting-edge labs which have the technology." According to The Messenger, in November, the DNA testing was finally completed after being sent off 2 months beforehand, with the results now returned to the authorities with a detailed DNA report. And that's kind of it. No news source has reported any updates since then. This could be for one of two reasons, really. Either it was nothing, there wasn't enough DNA for testing, and they didn't strike a match in the database, or this really is something and investigators are currently working on the investigation. Obviously, they're not going to come out and destroy their investigation by saying what it is they have. Perhaps in a few months' time, there'll be a big press conference announcing this case has been solved. Maybe, probably not though. Honestly, at this point, this case is so convoluted. Even if they have been able to find DNA, I don't really know what that means. Would they immediately be able to make an arrest? I don't know. I guess only time will tell. It depends what the evidence is, what the DNA is, how sort of damning it really is. Also, in a case updates video last year, I spoke about the case of Andrew Gosden, a 14-year-old boy who skipped school and boarded a train down to London's King Cross on the 14th September 2007, and then he just disappeared. He was captured on CCTV leaving the train station and then was never heard from again. In 2021, two men were arrested in connection with this case on suspicion of kidnap and human trafficking. But on the 20th September this year, the BBC reported that the two men had been released by police. Detective Chief Inspector Andy Knowles said that he was confident the two men arrested played no part in Andrew's disappearance, but that the investigation does remain open and active, and they would urge anyone with any information to come forward. Whilst it's encouraging for Andrew's parents, Kevin and Glenys Gosden, that this case is still being actively looked into by the authorities, of course they were very disheartened to find out this arrest wasn't really going to lead anywhere, that this was yet another dead end, and that they remain in limbo. They also said, "Our hearts go out to the men who've been exonerated of any involvement in Andrew's disappearance. They have no connection to our missing son, and we feel profoundly sorry for the inevitable distress that such allegations have caused." Imagine being so strong as to think of the people arrested for your son's disappearance, to have so much empathy, to make a statement apologising. I know obviously the men were innocent, there is zero connection, but I think it speaks to Kevin and Glenys' characters, they would be able to do something like that, to think of doing something something like that. Most people wouldn't, they just move on and continue with their search, but no, they come out and they apologise. They've been through so much, yet they're so careful with everyone else. It really is incredible. I do think people quite got their hopes up with this arrest in Andrew's case, as they are the only arrest that have ever been made in connection with Andrew. So you would assume the police had good reason for doing so, but sadly, obviously, it's led to nothing. Knowles has said that it's now been 16 years since Andrew's disappearance, and they're still hoping there are people out there who know something. In 16 years, people's views, opinions, loyalties can change massively. So maybe there are people out there who were too scared to come forward at the time, but maybe more willing now. The smallest bit of information could help in this case. They just want to find Andrew. As a very quick overview of his case, he was last seen in person at 8:30 in the morning on the 14th September 2007 in Bulby, Doncaster, as he headed down Littlemore Lane towards Westfield Park. It's thought that after his parents left to go to work, Andrew headed home and changed out of his school uniform. He took £200 out of his bank account and, without leaving a note, headed to Doncaster Station, where he bought a one-way ticket to London. It's believed that he actually actively refused to get a return ticket, despite it costing a very similar amount. It's believed that he boarded the 9:35 train to London, arriving in at King's Cross at 11:20 p.m. CCTV did capture him arriving, and he's never been seen since. Next up, move on to two updates and cases that are often linked in the eyes of the public. Two news presenters who were murdered, one in the UK, one in the USA. Jill Dando and Josie Huizentrout. I do want to preface my update in the Jodie Huizentrout case by saying this doesn't come directly from the authorities, but instead from a cold case sleuth called Steve Ridge, who's been looking into her case for many, many years. So just bear that in mind, maybe take this with a pinch of salt. Jodie was a news anchor for KIMT TV in Mason City, Iowa, when she vanished aged 27 in the early hours of June 27th, 1995. She told a colleague she overslept for work that morning, was running late, and being a news anchor, she worked very, very early hours, and then she just never turned up. There were signs of a struggle outside her apartment, and it's long been believed that she had been abducted, but there's never been any sign of her, despite exhaustive investigations. She was actually declared legally dead in 2001. Sleuth Steve Ridge told the US Sun that through his investigation, he'd found out that Jodie had met a man just 10 days before she went missing, with whom she'd had a fling. Now, it seems the police knew about this at the time and actually cleared this man of any involvement whatsoever. But the new theory is that somebody found out about this blossoming relationship. The pair apparently met in a bar near Jodie's home and they quickly formed a connection. They spoke every single day and it was usually Jodie initiating the calls. But she was very nervous to tell her friends about this relationship because she didn't want any unwanted drama. She just wanted to keep it private and to herself for the time being. Jodie was a very beautiful woman, and being a news anchor on TV, she had no shortage of admirers. She often wanted to keep relationships to herself, knowing that there would be the odd people out there who would be jealous, men who formed strange parasocial relationships with her through the TV. And Steve Ridge is convinced that this fling played a very important role in her disappearance, although he doesn't think that her abductor was a stranger. He said, "I believe without a doubt this relationship was clearly a factor in what happened because this was not a random act of violence. It wasn't anything like that. It wasn't a stalker that came out of nowhere. This clearly was someone that she knew and had interacted with who was very aware of all the relationships or people that she saw. And so that's why this is kind of sensitive information." Steve is sure that jealousy was the main motivation for Jodie's attacker. This might be the kind of information which could spark recognition for someone, so I figured it is worth sharing, even though it isn't really anything huge. Steve himself has doubled the financial reward for any information that could lead to the discovery of Jodie's body, so the reward now stands at $50,000. And as we all know, money talks. It's a very strong motivator. This case is still active. Apparently, they do have their eye on at least one person of interest, and hopefully it will be solved one day. What I have to share in the case of Jill Dando isn't exactly an update in this case, but I did just want to mention that Netflix recently released a documentary on this case entitled Who Killed Jill Dando, and I really think it's worth a watch. I saw some people sort of frustrated online that this documentary doesn't contain any new information, any breaking news in the case, but I think people forget that that is the point. This is a cold case, it's unsolved, there's nothing happening in it. A top watch documentary on Netflix might be exactly what's needed to encourage people to come forward with information. People who might now have previously realised that they have information to share. It actually really reminded me of a lot of comments I get on my channel. People would be like, why are you sharing this? You're not sharing anything new. Like, we know all this information. Like, no, I'm just compiling all the information into one place. Like, I'm not an investigator. I don't have like new, fresh information to share myself. Like, I don't know the cases personally. I'm just collating information from the internet and putting it into one place to hopefully spread the word. You don't always need fresh new information, fresh new evidence to make a case relevant again. Jill Dando was a TV journalist and presenter who was killed on the 26th of April 1999 when she was shot in the head at point blank range outside a home in Fulham in London. Now, this was a particularly peculiar case from here in the UK. Gun violence outside of gang situations is incredibly rare here. It happened in broad daylight, it was so brazen, yet the killer has never been found, nor has any solid motive, although plenty have been speculated over the years. I would just really recommend the documentary, and I ask that you recommend it to others in your life, particularly if you know anyone who lived in or around Fulham at the time of Jill's murder. Jill's brother, Nigel Dando, has spoken to the BBC since the release of the documentary, and he shared his own personal theory, saying, "My theory, which I had before this documentary, and more so since I've seen a greater insight into the police investigation, is that it was just someone who was in the street, who may or may not have known that she lived there, who was armed at the time and may have recognised her, who perhaps thought that he or she could get 5 minutes of notoriety by shooting her. And that is my view as to what happened. No matter how odd and strange people may think that is, it's certainly one of the theories that's abounded, that Jill was just in the wrong place at the wrong time." Of course though, that does make you wonder why this person never came forward if notoriety is what they craved. Now technically Jill's case is closed, but that doesn't mean it can't get solved. They just need someone to come forward with undeniable information, and the documentary might well help with that. It's been a while since I've given any update on Rex Huerman, the accused Gilgo Beach killer or Long Island serial killer. After his bombshell arrest in the summer, information surrounding this case kind of went quiet as the authorities focused on the investigation, but he appeared in court in November. Now, what I found most fascinating about this court appearance, that barely any media sites covered it for what it was, Rex Huerman appearing in court for his crimes. Most actually focused on the fact that Huerman's wife was in attendance, which is just crazy to me. Headlines saying that she turned up to assess the evidence for herself, which is totally understandable, but why was she the focus? It was actually really infuriating as I was trying to research for this update, reporting on how she's been silenced since the beginning, how she's divorced him, or like, what do you want her to say? Like, it's very much giving blame the woman for her husband's actions kind of energy. Like, every single headline about this November court date was about how his wife was in attendance, how she didn't say anything, how she had a documentary crew with her. Like, why is that the focus? Why is it about her, not about him and his crimes and the awful things he did? Huerman is currently charged with the murders of Melissa Barthelemy, Megan Waterman and Amber Costello, all of whom were found dead in Gilgo Beach in 2010. Now he has pled not guilty to each count, and he's also the prime suspect in the murder of Maureen Brainard Barnes. He's also being investigated in relation to the murder of Valerie Mack, and there has recently been a witness come forward making possible links between Karen Vergata and Huerman as well. Karen Vergata disappeared in early 1996, some of her remains were found on Fire Island that same year, and more were discovered on Gilgo Beach in 2011. A witness recently came forward after seeing photos of Karen and Huerman on TV, saying that she attended a swingers party at Huerman's Massapequa Park house around Valentine's Day 1996. The witness apparently attended with her boyfriend and with Karen, and then when the pair left, they left Karen there alone with Huerman. The details of this were spoken about in a press conference in October, with attorney John Ray saying, "The witness says to her partner, 'What are we doing? Are we taking her?' And the partner says, 'Don't worry, they're just playing a game. She stays there, no problem.'" With that, Karen runs out of the house naked and is running in front of the garage. And now the witness says, hey, shouldn't we be taking her? Something's wrong here. And the driver, the witness's boyfriend, just tells her, nah, they're playing a game, leave it. And so the pair leave. If this is true, that's pretty damning, but of course it is all alleged at this point. The point is, the witness says that she attended with her boyfriend and her boyfriend convinced her to leave Karen there alone with Heumann, despite Karen being in distress, it seems. And it's around that time that Karen disappeared. Connections between Heumann and other victims found along Ocean Parkway the following year, the victims of the alleged Long Island serial killer, do remain up in the air, although it has always been assumed that the Gilgo Beach and Ocean Parkway victims were very much connected. The cases are so intertwined, so similar. Now, the hearing in November was brief. Heumann's legal team has requested that prosecutors hand over all the investigative notes in this case dating all the way back to 2010. The court also heard how investigators took 13,000 photos of Heumann's Massapequa Park home in the search in the weeks following his arrest. He grew up in this home apparently, and he bought it off his parents 2 decades ago, so there's a very long history there, with Suffolk County officials saying they now fear that some of the victims could have been killed inside this home. Heumann's attorney also told the judge that his team has not yet received the full minutes from the grand jury indictment, saying that 75 pages were missing. So he's also asked to receive those in full, which prosecution have agreed to provide sometime in the future. Now, the next court day isn't scheduled in this case until the new year, so of course I'll keep an eye and report back. This is all going to be an incredibly long process, especially as he is pleading not guilty and insisting that he isn't responsible. For the full details of the arrest, I'll link my original updates video where I spoke about all the evidence in detail. This one's just an update on what's happened since then. I feel it's very important to stress that whilst Rex Heumann has been arrested for these crimes, he hasn't been found guilty yet. He is pleading not guilty, is innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. So as of right now, all of this is alleged. Of course, though, with his arrest, law enforcement agencies across the country have been trawling through their cold case files to see if any links can be made to Heumann. This happens whenever there's a big serial killer that's arrested, cold cases across the country are suddenly all linked. Lots of people have made connections to the New Bedford serial killer and the Eastbound Strangler. Now, obviously, nothing is confirmed, this is all speculation, thanks to geography, I suppose. The Eastbound Strangler investigation was revived again pretty soon after the news of Heumann's arrest came out, with 4 women, all of whom were sex workers, all found lined up in a sewage ditch behind a row of motels just west of Atlantic City. That's Kim Raffo, Tracy Ann Roberts, Barbara Bridle, and Molly Dills. After Heumann's arrest, Suffolk County Police Commissioner Rodney Harrison told ABC 7, "Shame on us if we don't look into Las Vegas, South Carolina, even Atlantic City. We've got to make sure if anyone has any information." Heumann had a timeshare property in Las Vegas, a property in South Carolina, and he was known to spend time in Atlantic City. So it's really not out of the question that if he is guilty of the Long Island crimes, there may be victims in places other than Long Island and Gilgo Beach. A dancer at Stiletto, a boardwalk strip club in Atlantic City, told Fox News Digital that she believes she encountered Heumann 3 times over the years, so twice before COVID and once in 2021. Each time he would allegedly pay her for a private room but declined a lap dance, instead asking her to sit and talk with him as he tried to persuade her to meet up outside the club. She said she declined as he made her very uncomfortable. The club in question is very close to the road leading to the place the Eastbound Strangler victims were found, and multiple other people working in this area have also recognised Heumann as a fairly infrequent visitor. In the summer, Atlantic City prosecutor William Reynolds told Fox News Digital, "Since this remains an open investigation, we cannot comment due to its potential to compromise the investigation. However, there is one key difference between the Long Island and Atlantic City crimes. The LISC never ever took steps to get rid of evidence because he knew the bodies wouldn't be found for a very long time. He hid the bodies really, really well. The Atlantic City perpetrator, however, barely even made an effort to hide the bodies, but did take steps to get rid of DNA evidence." Now, it's not out of question that more than one person with terrible intentions would head to Atlantic City to commit their crimes, which is a place with a very high concentration of sex workers, but there's definite links. Links can be made. It could be that if Heumann was responsible for the Atlantic City murders as well, maybe these were committed on holiday. He didn't have as much time, as much space to fully get rid of the body. So he just dumped them instead of actually going through the entire process that he did on Long Island. Again, alleged, we don't know, speculation. However, at the end of July 2023, it was said that Huerman was no longer being considered in the Eastbound Strangler case, and I don't know exactly why that is. The links to the Bedford Highway killer are a bit more tenuous, but I can't help but note similarities between that case and the Lisk. 11 female sex workers went missing between March 1988 and April 1989, although only 9 of the bodies were found, all along Route 140 in Massachusetts. Now, Massachusetts is in the northeast of the USA, the same as New York and New Jersey. It's about a 3-ish hour drive away from Huerman's home, so it's not out of the question that it could be linked. I always find it interesting how in the UK you would never ever link two cases a 3-hour drive apart. That's like half the length of our country. But in the USA, that's very close. It's all about context. So whilst the victims were all very similar, all sex workers, in terms of the actual crime, there weren't loads of similarities. The Bedford killer tended to leave bras wrapped around the neck as like a little signature, whereas nothing like that ever happened on Long Island. But it's not really wild for MOs to change over the years. I think it's definitely something that's worth looking into, like even just in case, but I'm sure the authorities already have slash actively are. As I said, I will be keeping a very close eye on this going forward as we move towards the trial. I'm sure even more information is going to be coming out over the coming months, coming years, but we won't know the bulk of it until the trial happens, and that could be years from now. There's a lot of evidence to collate. As always, I'm going to finish this episode with some updates in some Doe cases. Now, strangely enough, I actually don't have any identifications to share with you today. Fingers crossed I'll have some for you next time one of these episodes comes around, but instead I just have some sort of like general updates and pushes from investigators. Starting with Fred the Head, a case that I actually only covered in February of this year. The remains of a man are found in a mound of earth just off of Newton Road in Winchell in Staffordshire in 1971. The man was naked by his socks and his wrists and ankles had been bound behind his back. It was clear that somebody else had been involved in his death and in the hiding of his body. He did not do this to himself. He was given the rather awful but catchy nickname Fred the Head, and there have been basically no clues as to his identity over the years. But a man called Ken Davis took an interest in his case, taking on the job of hosting a podcast about this case simply named Fred the Head. And in April, it was reported that Ken Davies thinks he might have actually found Fred's true identity, having come across some very interesting information about a man called John Gick. John was 27 years old and single when he went missing in February 1969, which is 2 years before the body was discovered. He was a scoutmaster who travelled from the Isle of Man to Liverpool for a scouting event on the 1st of February 1969, and before the show he left his scouts with a colleague saying he had an appointment to go to. He then went to visit friends in Prenton and Wirral, leaving them around 4 p.m. with the intention of returning to Liverpool in time for the show at 6:40 p.m. And then he disappeared. According to the Liverpool Echo at the time, John was attacked by a gang of youth whilst leaving a gent's toilet at around 5 p.m, but no one knows what happened to him from there, whether he was killed in that attack or got disorientated and walked away, if something else happened after this point. His van was found abandoned on a Liverpool landing stage, just never picked up. But what evidence is there that John is Fred? Well, Davey suggests that it could make sense that Fred came from the Isle of Man. Fred the Head had extensive work done to his bottom teeth and had upper dentures, but no one has ever been able to find out where this work was done. Police at the time probably wouldn't have looked as far as the Isle of Man in their inquiries. Fred's age was somewhere between 23 and 39, John was 37. They both had very short hair, which is an uncommon hairstyle at this time. The remains were about 5'8", John was described around the same height. Fred had a neck condition called torticollis, and Davies believes that this could have been caused by the attack by the youths on the day that John disappeared. Fred was found in 1971 and is thought to have been in the ground for at least 18 months, which could match up with when John disappeared in 1969. Davies says that he has asked the police to conduct a DNA test to see if his hunch is correct, but nothing more has been made public since then, although it seems police have confirmed they are in touch with Davies. Again, this is very much a wait and see situation. DNA testing from here in the UK can take its sweet, sweet time, so I don't know when we'll have answers. And the very final case I want to talk about today is that of the Grundy County Jane Doe or Seneca Doe. This year, investigators have been making fresh appeals for information in her case. She was discovered in a ditch on the 2nd of October 1976 by a farmer. She was naked apart from a sweater tied around her head with a plastic bag and electrical tape over it. This was undeniably a case of murder when you add in the fact that she'd also been shot in the back of her head, execution style. Today, her death is the only cold case in Grundy County, Illinois, and now officials are asking for the tri-state's help, believing that she may have been born in Cincinnati. Coroner's office are working very closely with the DNA Doe Project in an attempt to identify her, and I have no doubt that her identity will be coming very, very soon. They just need that final push. According to WCPO.com, they have been able to identify a possible family tree for Jane Doe, with the DNA Doe Project saying that her closest DNA matches so far have common ancestors from the region of Selma, Alabama. They think that some descendants of those ancestors moved to Cincinnati at some point, and Jane Doe might have ties to the West End, although they're still trying to figure out exactly which descendant from those common ancestors in Selma moved to the Midwest and then became the parents and or grandparents of Jane Doe, if that makes sense. This is all just a very long and very complicated process. Family trees have so many branches, each of which has to be analysed fully. And a lot of the time when you do eventually find closer DNA matches, you're relying on the fact that people, like surviving people in the family tree, are going to know there's somebody missing. And a lot of the time people have no idea that somebody is even gone. This case happened decades ago and lots of people in the family tree would have been born after this point. They might not even know that Jane Doe ever even existed. So far, they figured out that Jane Doe was likely born between 1948 and 1960. One of her grandparents was likely named Calhoun and the other was named Harris. She might have siblings who, like I said, don't have a clue that she exists. Earlier this year, Grundy County Jane Doe was highlighted as DNA Doe Project's Case of the Month, as they wanted to spotlight things that make it more difficult to identify African American people through genetic genealogy. I don't think I mentioned, Jane Doe is African American. They said this is for multiple reasons, being that people from minority populations just don't tend to take DNA tests at the same rate as individuals who are Western European. This could be down to a lack of trust in the idea, or just a lack of trust in the authorities in general, or the fact that minority populations more often find themselves in poverty, so this really isn't a priority for them. It's also difficult to obtain genealogical records from the time during and around slavery. Lots of people in this time changed their names. People didn't know who their families were. Records weren't kept. There's only so far back you can go. In highlighting Jane Doe's case, they hoped that someone out there might recognise her. An old classmate, a friend, a cousin, a relative, anything. I really do suspect that Jane Doe's identity isn't too far around the corner, but they do ask that anyone with any information about this case contact the Grundy County Coroner's Office at 815 941 2259, or you can email bjohnson@grundycountyill.gov. The smallest thing could help put the final pieces of this puzzle together for the investigators. Do you live in Cincinnati? Do you know somebody that would have around this time? Share her story. And as this case is so many decades old now, time really is of the essence. If they want to provide people with answers, it needs to be soon. They've been working on this case, working on the DNA since around 2021, I think. It's now nearly 2024, so this case is moving really, really slowly. They just want answers. They just want to put her to rest. And that's the situation for every single case I've covered in today's episode. All of these families, all of these people, they just want answers. They want to be able to put it to rest. They want closure to be able to move on. Of course, you're never really going to get over something like this. You're never going to be able to fully move on. But answers, like I know if something like this was to happen to one of my loved ones, I would go to the end of the earth just to have some form of closure, just to know what happened. Honestly, the strength of some of these families just never ceases to amaze me. I don't know how they manage to go on every single day, and I really hope that in sharing these stories, we can just help a little bit, just put the stories out there, get that one step, one tiny inch closer to some answers, hopefully one day. Thank you so much for tuning in today. If I missed any case updates, then please feel free to put them in the comments down below. Again, I try really hard to keep up to date with every single case, but all the time, it's you guys who let me know at the moment there's an answer. And honestly, I am so, so incredibly grateful for that. And I suppose I will see you in the next one. Bye, guys.